I want to thank you all for coming here tonight. And as he said, my name is Randy Randall, and I do have the great pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight, who is Dr. Norman Wiersbe. But before I do that, I need to speak with you a little bit about why he's here in the first place. And for the past several years, my wife and I have been struggling with the question, how do we fully know Christ? Or how can we know him more fully? And how is it that our mind is actually renewed in all things so that we can actually see things and understand things the way that he does or he would want us to? And for me, it's not always been an easy road, a lot of bumps along the way. But ultimately, I did come to realize the fact that that the arts actually play a critical role in this understanding of Christ and understanding of love for God. And so we founded this Kalos Foundation. And that word is a Greek word that has an interesting meaning of good and beautiful and proper and fitting. That whole idea, all of those four things together summarize of what the effort is. And so the purpose of this foundation, then, is to support the often neglected arts in the Christian faith. We not only want to understand these things better ourselves, but we want to share that understanding with others and to bring speakers here and people who can instruct us so that we can better understand how really to encourage others and to assist others in understanding God's beauty and truth and goodness in the modern world. And so for the past 2 years, we've actually hosted a couple of different people in that effort. The first was Ken Myers, who came and talked to us. He was from Mars Hill Audio and spoke on the Christian understanding of beauty. Last year, we had Dr. Ralph Wood from Baylor University, who came and spoke to us on the writings of both Flannery O'Connor and J.R.R. Tolkien. And what he showed there was that through their writings, their faith became manifest and would often bring things to mind that we might otherwise not see. For example, the beauty of friendship in the Fellowship of the Ring and what true friendship really meant. We've also had the painter John Cobb come to the Tyler Museum of Art in support of his work, which was his beautiful work in which he painted the extraordinary beauty of ordinary things and ordinary people. And then we also helped to support a harpist, Greg Buchanan, who came here last month. And so you may ask yourself, well, how can a man who has written a book called Food and Faith, how does that indeed relate to the arts? Well, if you think about the arts, though, and what is required for that, it requires a full engagement of our mind. Our reason has to be there, our creativity, and our imagination. And I don't know of anyone who has thought more carefully, more imaginatively, or more creatively about food and eating than this man right here, Dr. Norman Wiersbe. And I first heard of him when I read a book by Wendell Berry. The book is The Art of the Commonplace, and in it, Dr. Wiersbe has written the preface or the foreword to that book. And I remember reading that book because I was so excited to read more of Wendell Berry. But after I read the introduction, I thought, who is this man? We need to have him come here. And believe it or not, here he is tonight. So that's very exciting for me. And the insight, even in that 10-page forward or so, was so profound, so insightful, and so, frankly, revolutionary that it made me very uncomfortable, and the book does too. So Dr. Norman Wiersbe, he is a professor at Duke Divinity School, and he has another great title of Professor of Theology, Ecology, and Rural Life, which I think is just a great title. He's written a number of books, and perhaps his most famous is this one I've already mentioned, Food and Faith, A Theology of Eating. Now, when people have commented on this particular book, their comments have been pretty much the same. Ken Myers wrote about this book, or in the interview with Dr. Wiersbe on his tapes, wrote that it's the best book he'd ever read on the most fundamental of practices of all humanity, the act of eating. Because eating is something we do day in and day out, and most of us never give a moment's thought to it other than simply saying a mindless grace or a prayer before the meal itself. Stanley Hauerwas, who's professor of theological ethics at Duke, confessed in his foreword to this very book that he did not want to know much of what I learned by reading this book. He, in fact, would have preferred to remain ignorant because it was easier that way. It was hard to know the truth of what a theology of food would be, his life and our life are rooted in this selfishness and this willful ignorance of the fact that food, for example, requires sacrifice, no matter what food it is. But as Christians, as those who are seeking to know Christ and who want to know him better, know him more, we must know the truth of this and of all things. And we must be able to see that food is indeed God's love made delectable. So, Dr. Wiersbe?
Good evening, everyone. We're going to be talking about the culinary arts, right? So we have to make the connection to art. And food is good and beautiful and tasty. So first, I want to pick up on something that Randy said in his introduction, which is that we have this problem of people that we're we do things that are sometimes intentional, sometimes they're not intentional. Eating is one of these activities that, for the most part, have been unintentional in our lives. And I want to impress upon you how new that is in human history. We're going to have to pay a little bit of attention to that as we go along. But my overall goal will be to have you think a little bit more carefully about why the Bible is saturated with food. And that it's not just a kind of window dressing in the Bible, but food actually becomes one of the ways that we understand something profound about who God is, about who we are, and also about how we're supposed to live in the world. But first, let's think about food more generally before we get to this more specific theological discussion. For many of us, food is just a commodity. Okay, it's fuel. So how many of you think that? I got to eat because, you know, I have to move. And if I don't eat, I can't get out of bed. Right? It's a bad thing if you don't eat. So you need the energy that comes from food. And we'll need to think about, well, what does it mean to say that food is a commodity? Right? How does that give us a picture about the whole world that we need to take into account? And what does it say about the kind of people we want to be if we think about food primarily as a commodity? How many of you think about food as your enemy? Any of you? There's reason for that, because you know food can make you fat. Or maybe you've got a food allergy. Any food allergies out here? Any gluten intolerant people? Right, in my book, I talk a lot about bread, and I just was so excited. I thought what I was doing with bread was really cool. And then one of my students said, well, I'm gluten intolerant, you know. Oh, all that beauty for nothing. How many of you know that food can kill you? Right? We've heard about some food scares involving E. coli, salmonella. But even if you do the old-fashioned thing like you can some of your own food, you have to be very careful because you don't want botulism. That'll kill you. So sometimes people have a relationship with food which is to characterize it as an enemy. We also know that in today's food system, we've got lots of different food products. Okay? So you go into a typical grocery store. What's the typical chain around here? Do you have Safeway down here? Brookshire's, all right. I'm going to guess that there will be anywhere between 30 and 40,000 different food products in that store. Right? On total, there's more than 50,000. Now, why have all these different kinds of food? Okay? We know when people come from other parts of the world and they walk into our grocery stores, what's the impression that they get? Right? They're astounded. Because you don't just buy Cheerios. You have to decide which of the 10 different kinds of Cheerios you will purchase, because each kind of Cheerio has a kind of name and branding and style that goes with it. And you know that there are yogurts for slim women, and then there are yogurts that are for the hard-working man. And there are certain kinds of entrees that only a man eats, like Hardee's Thick Burger. And I remember the scandal that was on television when they had a commercial where this young, beautiful thin woman was eating a Hardee's Thick Burger, because that's not what beautiful women are supposed to eat. Right? Don't tell that to my daughter, though. Right? We associate foods with certain kinds of style, certain kinds of identity, and that happens on a very personal level. It happens in a gendered kind of way. Men eat certain kinds of things. Women eat certain kinds of things. If you're of this class person, you eat certain kinds of food. Right, we know this. We just look at our fast food restaurants. Right, there's sort of what we might call entry level fast food, and then there's chic fast food on the top end, and you know who's going to be in these different kinds of places. They're identity markers. And then of course there's the larger one, which is sort of ethnic traditions. You know, you can eat Chinese, Mexican, Tex-Mex. You can do Ethiopian and Indian and all these different kinds of foods. And they all have with them associations about the food, but also the people who eat the food. And sometimes this gets a little bit comical, right? Because, say, if you're eating Italian food, some companies, they want you to think that you're back in an Italian village in Tuscany and the wheat is ground by a mule rolling a rock around, right? Of course, nothing like that is actually happening, but you want to participate in the aura of what that food represents. All of which is to say that food is a really big deal. And it's deeply, deeply personal. Many of us eat foods and we don't think about them. But if you were to say you should stop eating that food, we'd get very upset. Because that's my food. Right? Or maybe you grew up eating a certain kind of way and now you're wondering, can I change because the person I married is vegan? You realize how much is at stake, which is one of the reasons I tell students right off, you know, we're going to study food, we're going to learn about food systems, and we're going to learn a lot of things that are not really good. They're not very happy. And the first rule of learning to do theology of eating is not to become the food police, right? To not go around and start pointing fingers at everybody saying, you should not eat that. You should not drink that. Do you know how bad that company is? Right? That's not very helpful. I think it's much more important to learn how we can be merciful with each other and merciful with the world in whatever kind of eating that we do. I think that becomes the really important task. Right, so that's just some general stuff about food. Now, we have to ask another question. How many of you are farmers today? All right, look around. How many of you have parents that grew up on farms? Okay, now grandparents. Okay, do you notice what's happened here? What have you seen? First round, there was one hand up. And then more hands went up, and then a lot of hands up. Okay, this is a reflection of something that is really important for us to understand. It's called urbanization. It's been going on in America for a good long time. Parts of Europe, it's been going on for a long time. But the truth is that for thousands of years, okay, did you hear that? Thousands of years, most every human being understood where their food came from because they had a direct hand in its growth and production. We are the first generation in human history where we have more people living in cities than living on farmland. And we have to ask, what happens when we no longer have direct, tactile, daily experience in the growth of our food? What do we lose? Okay, there's obviously been a lot gained by becoming urban people. But what have we lost? And I don't just mean head knowledge. Because you can read books about agriculture. But when you are a farmer yourself, one of the things that you learn very, very quickly is that the way you think about your life makes no sense apart from the health of your land and the health of your plants and the health of your livestock. So that your daily expectations, even your desire as a human being, was in alignment with the health of your farm. And so you structured your days, your weeks around what the land needed, what the animals needed. And I remember I grew up farming in Western Canada, and I remember being very annoyed with my city friends because they would always say, well, Norm, let's just go do this. Let's take off for the weekend. And I say, I can't. Who's going to change the irrigation pipes? Who's going to feed the animals? And of course, that was a source of jokes to them, right? Norm can't go have fun because he's got to deal with chickens. And it would make me furious because I wanted to say, look, if it isn't people like me taking care of chickens, you don't get to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken at midnight. Right? And so these city friends of mine made fun of farmers because they thought that they were tied down. And we have to ask ourselves, what has happened to our human sensibilities when we think that the people who grow food are the bearers or the objects of our ridicule, even disdain? Because in our culture, if someone asks, what do you want to do when you grow up, and you say you want to be a farmer, do people applaud and cheer and say, yeah, go for the gold? We wonder, why would you want to be a farmer? Okay, what does that say about us as people when we no longer think that agriculture matters? So much so that we have more prison inmates in America than we have farmers. The U.S. Census Bureau does not even put farmer as a category for job classification. A friend of mine was marrying a Canadian. I'm a Canadian. And crossing the border, the border official said, well, what is the occupation of this man you're about to marry? And she said, well, he's a farmer. And he says, well, that's ridiculous. You can't come in the country. She said, well, why not? And she said, well, because farmers can't make any money, so you will be dependent on the state. Right? This is where we are in our culture. The result of this urbanization is that we have become the most ignorant eaters the world has ever known. We don't have a clue where food comes from. And more importantly, we don't know what's necessary for food to be available in the long term. Because we go into our grocery stores and we see that they're always stocked and the food looks good, it's beautifully packaged, we think the food is going to be there all the time. But if you study agricultural systems, you discover we got lots of reasons to lose some confidence here. Because the growth of food over the long term requires healthy soil, requires clean, available water. It requires fertility. It requires what? Reliable weather patterns. All kinds of things. Farmers are always talking about the weather for a reason, because their very livelihood depends upon it. But when we don't know any of those sorts of things, we take food for granted. And when we take food for granted, we actually give our proxies to economic policies that further undermine food's productivity. Right? I'm not going to go into a litany of all the really bad things that are happening in the food system. That would just be too depressing on a Friday night, you know, and I'm just grateful that you're here on a Friday night, you know. But those are things that you have to start asking yourself, right? If you get interested in food, start doing some research on where's food coming from? What's our food system like today? Is it producing good food? And can it produce good food for a very long time, right? We're not just talking 10 years, right? I'm guessing most of you will want to eat 20 years from now or 50 years from now, or you'll want your grandkids to be able to eat 100 years from now. Right? So we have to ask these questions about long-term viability of our food system. And when you start asking those questions, we got lots of reasons to be concerned. So now let's start to move away from these more general thinking points and start asking the question about how does food register in a biblical, theological sort of way? When I wrote this book, Food and Faith, I had friends say to me, boy, you theologians, you've got nothing better to do. Right? Why would you be worried about food as a theologian? So I decided I was going to read the Bible again with the question in mind, where is food showing up and how does food show up? And the first thing I discovered is that food is everywhere. But you have to be asking about it to notice that it's everywhere. Right? So one commentator on Luke's gospel said, Jesus in the whole gospel is either coming from a meal, at a meal, or going to a meal. Which makes perfect sense. Because in most cultures, you organized your life around meals. You just did. We don't do that today. We do other things that are more important, and then we just get a bite on the go, and we're done in 10 minutes. And there's no more thought to the food. Right? Very different cultural context than the context of the Bible. But then you read passages like, don't worry about what you're going to eat. Don't worry about what you're going to wear. And so you start to think, oh, see, even Jesus says, don't worry about food. Well, worry about food might be wrong. But maybe we need to think about food. And the question is, why? Right? Why would food be important in the Bible? And the short answer that I'll give you, then we'll sort of build up on it, is food matters profoundly in the Bible because food is the most basic expression of God's love for us. All right? You got to hear that. Food is the most basic expression of God's love for us. Because remember, God creates a world in which every living creature has to eat. And the moment living creatures can no longer eat, they die. And so for there to be food available is one of God's most basic, but also God's highest priorities. Which is why in the Bible, if there are people who don't have food to eat, does that make God happy? Right? Absolutely not. In fact, the judgment of the nation of Israel depended upon how well fed its poor people were. And so that there, if there were hungry in their midst, this was reason to call down God's judgment upon them. But before we can get to this description about why is food the basic expression of God's love, we have to ask a very basic question. And that is, how do we name food? Right, how do we narrate this reality? Right, we said earlier you can talk about food as a commodity. Okay, this is a really destructive naming. Here's why. Because when you name something as a commodity, what you're putting in place is a whole description of what the world is. How does this work? Imagine that I bring a plant and I put it right here. And I say, okay, that plant right there, that plant is a weed. Okay, what are you thinking right now when you hear that word weed? Yeah, you're thinking Roundup. You're thinking, where's the hole? Okay, or some dog that needs to go to the bathroom or something. That's what you're thinking about because that's what weed means. But then I say, oh, wait a minute, people, I made a mistake. It's not a weed. You know what that is? That's a flower. Okay, now what are you thinking? Where's the miracle grow? You want to see this baby grow more, right? And you don't want to whack it down or poison it. What you want to do is you want to be able to enjoy it, behold it, take in its beauty, smell its fragrant odor. But then I say, oh, wait a minute, people, I made a mistake. It's not a flower. It's a tomato plant. Now what are you thinking? Yeah, you can't wait until we start to see those beautiful red fruit tomatoes growing on that thing. Because then when you put it in your mouth, you get a flavor explosion in your head. Right? How cool is that? So now you're thinking, I'm going to nurture this plant, protect this plant, so that it will grow to maturity, produce its fruit, so that I can then feed it to people that I care about. It's been the same plant. I just named it three different things. And if you think that's far-fetched, look at your lawn sometime. The things that you call weeds, if you let them grow, they're beautiful. You can even eat them. A friend of mine, Cal DeWitt, he's a wetlands ecologist, one of the most wonderful beholders of the world I've ever met, moved into this town, and they had these ordinances about how you You have to make sure your lawns look like carpets. There can't be anything else in the lawn. And he realized, I can't do this because I know that to have a lawn like that, I got to put lots of poison in the world. He said, I'm not going to do it. So he decided to let his garden, his lawn just grow. And all these little flowers, purple and yellow and white, were growing. And he had dandelions. Some of you are getting really nervous right now. So he'd take his camera and take pictures of them and make postcards. And he sent them to his neighbors and he served them tea. And they said, oh, your postcards are so beautiful. He said, oh, you like them. He said, yeah, where are those flowers from? And he said, my lawn. And then they were drinking the tea and they said, this tea is so good. What kind of tea is it? He said, it's dandelion tea. I made it from my lawn. And these neighbors were horrified. And he said, now, you all don't use your dandelions to make tea because your dandelions have got all this poison on them and you'll actually kill yourself. But it made the point. It's about how you see things, how you name them. Weed, flower, fruit. That determines how you are going to respond to them. Okay, this is the crucial point. If you name something a weed, you're going to want to destroy it. That's the response that grows in you. Now the question is, how do we name the world? The whole planet that we live in. Because how you name it is going to determine how you live in it. And what I want to suggest to you is that when we name food a commodity, we are setting up an understanding of the world as one big store. And our relationship to that store is simply to go in there and purchase whatever we want. And it sort of features in all of our vocabulary, right? Because we talk about our world as being a stockpile of natural resources. And so the whole world becomes a really big warehouse. And all you got to do is have your money, your capital, your investment, and you go get it. And yeah, maybe you have to fight some people to get it. Maybe you have to do a little extra work to get it. But the point remains, your job is to go in there and get it. And all you need is capital. And for consumers, all you need is a credit card. And all you need to do is just swipe that baby and you can have the world at your fingertips. Now the question is, do you think that's how God understands the world? Right? Do you think God envisions the world that God has made as a big warehouse? And do you think God wants us to relate to this world with the ignorance and the ease of a credit card swipe? Right? I wonder. Right? I think there's a reason why in the creation story that happens in the Garden of Eden, after God plants the garden, has the human being come out of the ground by breathing into this soil, what does God do with this person, this first Adam? Anyone remember? Yeah, God puts this Adam in the garden and instructs the Adam, till and keep the garden. Sometimes we read that and we think, oh, this is an example of how God has cursed human beings by gardening. Because if you've tried to garden or farm, you know it's hard work. And so clearly gardening and farming, that's a curse. Which, of course, is ridiculous. You need to understand God's putting this Adam in the garden to garden as an invitation by God to this Adam to participate in God's gardening ways with the world. Because it's through the work, okay, the work of gardening, that this Adam is going to learn something about himself, about who he is, and what he needs to do to live well on this earth. He's going to have to learn about patience, right? Because gardening is all about patience. He's going to have to learn about his own impotence, because as a gardener, you can't make stuff happen. You can support the work of the garden, but in the end, you don't know if you're going to have fruit. You don't know if disease or pests or blights are going to come by. And that's what's so humiliating about being a gardener. And to be in a garden, you're constantly facing death. And who wants to do that? That's a real downer. So we've all walked away from the garden. And we've become ignorant. We've become impatient. We've become arrogant. And we're now using the power that we have. And there is no doubt that human beings have incredible power now. But we're using that power to bulldoze, burn, and poison our way through the world. Right? What happened to the sense that we are supposed to have something like a gardener's disposition in the world, which is about taking care of things, being attentive to things? And I want to suggest to you that the whole framing of food as just a commodity reinforces in our mind the idea that we can just be ignorant consumers who pluck from the world whatever we want. Is there a different way to name food? Well, it's the title of this lecture. Food is God's love made delectable. Okay, that's a strange way to speak. Why should I put it this way? Well, we have to ask the question, how does the Bible present the world to us? If it's not presenting the world to us as one big warehouse or store, is there a different way to name it? And the biblical answer is, well, of course there is. It's called creation. Okay, and in creation, what we're talking about are the works of God's hands. And what are these works? How do things register if they don't register as commodities? Well, you have to back up and ask the question, why does God make a world at all? Because we believe that God doesn't lack anything. So it's not that God has to create because God's lonely or needs friends or something like that. And when theologians have tried to think about why God creates the world, the best answer they've come up with is that God creates because God loves. And love takes a very particular form, right? Love takes the form of God making something other than God to be and to flourish and to thrive. And so everything that God makes is the material manifestation of that divine love. So every creature is God's love made visible, God's love made auditory, God's love made fragrant, God's love made tactile, God's love made delectable. Right? Is it astounding to you that we live in a world that has the potential to taste incredibly good? Right? Are you astounded by that? Right? You should be. Because there's nothing about the world which would suggest that it has to taste good. It could have just been fuel, right? But that's not how God sees it. Because food is the expression. It's the medium, the material medium of God's love. It's God's way of saying daily to you, I love you, I want to take care of you, and I want you to enjoy yourself. Which is why it's such a tragedy that we've got such food that tastes bad. Right? So God creates this world out of love, and every creature is God's love made physical, God's love made material. Which means then that food is God's love made delectable. God cares about food because food is the expression of his own love. And this is the other point that I think Christians have real difficulty with. God loves the world fiercely. Right? Do you hear that? God loves the world fiercely. And that means the material world. Right? We could spend a lot of time looking at different passages, but I'll just read one to you. This is Psalm 104. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Yonder is the sea, great and wide. Creeping things innumerable are there. living things, both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan that you form to sport in it. Right now, why is Leviathan in there? That's important. Right? Leviathan is the sea creature that will kill human beings if you get close. And God's saying here, I love this creature. These all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. Right? This is a beautiful passage describing about how God is always present to the world as the feeding presence of every creature, as the animating presence of every creature, so that if God were to turn away, everything would die and fall to the ground. Okay, and the image you have to have in mind here points back to Genesis 2, when the first human being, but not just human beings, plants and animals and birds too, come out of the ground. God holds this soil so close as to breathe into it the breath that now is the breath circulating through you. That's the intimacy that God has with the world. And it's an intimacy founded upon God's love for every material creature. I think this is hard for Christians, especially now in our culture, to hear, because so much of Christianity has become Gnostic. Have you heard that term before, Gnostic? Okay, Gnosticism is a fancy term for the idea that what God cares about is really only your soul. Okay, God worries about whether or not your individual soul will get to heaven. And that's what a lot of Christianity is about, how to get your soul to heaven. Do you realize that that's a heresy to preach that? The Bible in no way supports that view. And there's lots of reasons that you could give for why the Bible wouldn't support that view. One of the very basic reasons is what I've already told you. The material world is God's love made physical. So how could God ever despise the material world? Or how could God ever despise a human body? Think about this. God's full revelation of himself happens where? In a book? No. In a body. The body of Jesus of Nazareth. Fully human, fully divine. Why a human body? And then think about, well, what is Jesus doing his whole time? He's engaged in various ministries. Ministry of healing. Okay, now why would he do that if bodies didn't matter? Ministry of exorcism. Okay, now why is that happening? I mean, it freaks us out a little bit, I know. But because if you have an evil spirit within you, it will turn against the body and destroy it, right? Think about the Gerasene demoniac. Where did he live? In a cemetery, in the tombs, right? And he lived, as Mark's gospel, I think it's Mark's gospel, says, a death-like existence. Jesus doesn't want anybody to live a death-like existence. And God is always touching bodies through Jesus. God is feeding bodies through Jesus. Right? Jesus is in the food business. And I think we should ask the question, as churches today, should we be in the food business? Given that food is, even for us today, still one of the most powerful ways we can express our love for other people. Right? You know this if you cook for other people. If you're intentional about it, what's happening is your love is being communicated to them. I had a grandmother who cried if I didn't eat her food because it amounted to a rejection of her and her love for me. Now, you can go overboard with that, I know, but even so, Food registers in our minds as the expression of love. What if churches were to say, well, let's make food ministry central to who we are? Right? What would that look like? Right? Maybe it would start just by eating together a lot more, inviting people in more to eat with us, especially people who need food. Or maybe it would mean churches getting involved in the growth and production of food. Right? A lot of churches, they're sitting on land. What if they turn some of these ornamental lawns and shrubs and trees into fruit-bearing trees? Or turned up some of this sod and decided, let's build a garden here. And let's use the garden as a place to learn about spiritual formation. Right? Let's use the garden as a place that we can grow food for people who need healthy food. Let's bring people from the community into the garden to work with us as a way of outreach in our communities. Because I've talked to a number of pastors who have started church gardens, and they'll tell you, right, there are difficulties involved for sure, but they'll say it's the most visible part of our ministry today. Because people see a garden and they say, how do you argue against a garden? People from the neighborhood come and it's a safe place. It's a place where you can do work that's noble. It's good. It results in fruit that you can eat, right? It's beautiful. Because you see, eating is the expression of God's love, but it's also the expression and the extension of God's own hospitality with the world. When theologians have tried to understand God's work of creativity, they say that one of the best ways to describe this action is by using the metaphor of hospitality. Because when you are hospitable to another, you make room for them. You say, come into my world. Let me nurture you and feed you so that you can leave on your own better than when you came. Nurtured, taken care of, so that you can fully realize yourself in the world. Right? That's the character of God's love. Right? God's love is not coercive. God's love is this hospitable love that seeks your full development. And so when you think in the Gospels about Jesus' ministries and the miracles that Jesus performs, right, we've been trained to think that miracles are interruptions in the laws of nature. Well, for ages, theologians said, that's crazy. Miracles are not interruptions. They're acts of liberation. Because when you're hungry, you can't fully function. You can't fully be yourself. If you're sick, you can't fully be yourself. If you're grasped by a demon, you can't be yourself. And so Jesus, in performing miracles in these contexts, what he does is he removes those obstacles called hunger and disease and demon possession, right? Animosity between people. He removes those so that the creatures can be liberated to become themselves again. Because this is God's hospitality at work. Right? It's remarkable. I've been saying that food is the expression of God's love, that it's God's love made delectable. I know that sounds pretty cheery, right? I mean, who wouldn't want to go around saying, food is God's love made delectable? Isn't that nice? Big group hug. But of course, it's difficult. Because if you're involved in the production of food, and if you're paying attention when you are eating food, you know that for any one of us to eat, others have to die. Okay, do you realize that? Even if you're a vegetarian, for you to eat, others have to die. And our society does everything it can to hide that fact from us, so that when you go into a store, there are no vestiges of life anywhere. Except maybe some of the produce aisle. But even there, we get a little nervous, right? Because when those potatoes and you got those little buds forming on them, ooh! Right? Those buds, that's the promise of new life. We want our potatoes clean, not even any dirt on them. What is it about us? We want our meat without any trace of feather or bone or fur or blood. The reality, of course, is different. Sometimes when we have people over for dinner, I don't get to do this anymore, though. My wife won't let me. I would pray, like at Thanksgiving, you know, thank you for all the people that are here, and we're so glad they're here, and thank you for the turkey that died so that we could eat it. And after the prayer was done, everyone would say, oh, I don't want to eat now. To which I respond, and more for me. Yeah, that's one. Yeah, that would have been a good comeback line. But my line is, this is a revelation? You didn't know that the turkey we're going to eat was once a living bird? And the answer is, some of them didn't know. They didn't make the connection. Right? But that's the reality. And so the big question is, how do any of us become worthy of another's life or death? Right? If you're going to eat, how do you make yourself worthy of the life and death that you're going to consume? This is not an easy matter. But I think here too, the Bible has a response. And the response is sacrifice. My guess is that you know that in ancient Israel, there was a temple. And before there was a temple, there were altars at which sacrifice happened. And I know for a lot of us, the idea of sacrifice is utterly repulsive. Why would God ask Noah, after having just saved all these animals in the ark, to build an altar and sacrifice animals of every kind? And why would God find the odor of these burnt animals pleasing? We think that's disgusting. Well, I think we have to back it up a little bit. You have to recall that sacrifice only ever involved domesticated animals, which meant that the only animals that ever showed up at that altar that were killed and burned, and then the meat consumed by the priests and the people, by the way, that's really the only time they ate meat. You have to understand that these domesticated animals weren't just anything. Right? If you're agricultural people, or if you're a shepherd, and you bring your good animal to the altar, what you are giving is yourself. Because you're giving the investment of all the energy and resources and time you have put into that animal. And so this is where the idea that this was a real sacrifice for the farmer or the shepherd comes in. Because to lose breeding stock, that's huge. And so every offering at the altar was both the offering of the animal or the first fruit, and it was the offering of the farmer, him or herself. And the most important element in that offering was the self offering, which is why when you get to the prophetic books later on in the Bible, God says, I don't want your stinking sacrifice anymore. You know why? Because the people weren't offering themselves anymore. They were just purchasing an animal at the gate. And the way the prophets knew that these people were not offering themselves anymore is that there were poor people in their midst. There were hungry people in their midst. There was injustice in the land. Because to offer yourself means you give yourself to others so that they can thrive. So that they can be healthy and whole. So, come back to my question. How do you make yourself worthy of the life and death that you eat? The answer, I think, is you do it sacrificially, which means you offer yourself to what you eat. And I know that sounds kind of bizarre, but let me give you an example. Growing up in Alberta, my grandfather was one of the farmers that I worked with. And every day, from spring through fall, after lunch, he would get a bucket and a scythe, and he would go find grass that was about 6 inches tall, and he'd mow it down, put it in the bucket, and walk to the chicken coop. And every day, these chickens knew what was coming. They'd see him, and they'd come running. And these chickens, they had smiles on their faces. Have you ever seen a chicken smile? It's beautiful. He would throw the grass in the air, and these chickens would frolic and jump. They'd be so excited as they gobbled up the grass. Years later, I look back on this and I ask myself, why in the world did he do that? Doesn't make sense, because he's a busy man. He's got a lot to do on his farm. And yet, he stops every day to cut his chickens some grass. Right? These were free-range chickens before we had that term. They could go anywhere they wanted on the farm, get whatever grass they wanted. And the best thing I could come up with is that my grandfather believed chicken happiness mattered. Really, truly. And he believed that if he's going to eat chickens, he had to make sure his chickens were happy. And so on our farm, any brutality towards animals was strictly forbidden. Because animals are the gifts of God, given to us. They're put under our care. And if we're going to eat them, we have to show them respect. And not just respect, we have to show that we care about them enough to want to nurture them into their own happiness. Now contrast that way of raising chickens with today's industrial chicken. How many of you know about today's industrial chicken lots? It's pretty frightening. It's a condition of unremitting brutality. Why? Because they're not chickens. They're economic units of production. And the only thing that matters is how cheaply can you produce them? And if it means we have to genetically modify them so that they will grow to maturity in 45 days instead of 85, we'll do it. Even if it means they won't be able to walk, they'll have severe gastrointestinal troubles, they'll be in darkness the whole time, they'll be surrounded by toxic fumes. Right? My grandfather, he offered himself to his chickens. He honored the chickens. He lived in a sacrificial sensibility. Today's industrial chicken, there is no sacrificial sensibility at all. There is no love at all in this system. Now you might say, okay, but that was in the Old Testament, right? That's the temple. And we even read in Hebrews that Jesus put an end to sacrifice. Does that mean sacrificial ways of living are over? That Christians no longer need to offer themselves to each other and to the world? Right? I don't think so. I think when it says that Jesus is the end of sacrifice, what's really being meant here is that Jesus is the fulfillment of sacrifice. So that if you want to know what a sacrificial life looks like, look to Jesus. And the mode of sacrificial living, the mode of self-offering, is the mode of the ministries of healing and feeding and touching and reconciling and feasting together. Because that's how we not just show our love to others, but it's how we witness to God's more primordial love. And I think it's no accident that for Christians, one of the central rites, one of the most central things that we do is we practice the Lord's Supper, or what's sometimes called the Eucharist. What do you call it around here? Lord's Supper? Eucharist? Right? Why do we do that? Why is it a meal that Christians do? I know it's hard to believe that it's a meal because sometimes it's like a tiny little thing. It's like a nibbling session more than anything else. But why would a meal have been central to the formation of Christians? Well, there's lots of ways you can talk about it, but I'll end with this one way. In John 6, Jesus refers to himself as the bread of life. Right? It's a really astounding thing to say. What is it about this bread of life that Jesus is that makes his ministry so vital to what we can now do in the world? Well, when you eat regular bread, it goes into your stomach and it's absorbed, digested, and it's gone. Theologians would say that Jesus, as the bread of life, goes into you, but he's not digested and gone. When you take Jesus into you, he stays there and transforms you from within. So it's more like Jesus digests you from the inside. I know that doesn't sound really appealing, but work with me here. The point is what Paul describes in Galatians when he says, "It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me." Okay, what's that language about? Well, you have to have Jesus in you. And there is no more intimate way to have somebody in you than to eat them. And Jesus now inside of you becomes this destabilizing, restabilizing, transforming presence. So that you can now leave the table equipped to live the way Jesus lives. As my friend Sam Wells put it, at the Lord's table, Jesus becomes our food so that we can become food for the world. Right? Jesus becomes our food so that we can be food for the world. In other words, Jesus becomes our nurture so that we can nurture others around us. And not just nurture other people, but nurture the whole world of creation, because that's what God is doing all the time. Okay? God is daily feeding every creature that lives. And as Christians, we have this marvelous opportunity to become intentional about our eating. Realize, first of all, that it is God's love made delectable. And then in the various forms of our personal lives, but also our life together as communities formed by Christ, we have the opportunity to witness to God's love in the world by extending that love in all sorts of practical ways. And the really wonderful thing about this is that in this case, doing the right thing tastes really good. What a deal. So I'll stop there.